Welcome to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you will hear articles from the April 25th to May 1st edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, an illustration of President Donald Trump, blue suit, red tie, sitting on and partially crushing what seems to be a ballot box. Some ballots are strewn around on the floor. Ballots that didn't make it into the box, and or ballots that squirted out of the box due to pressure. It would seem, can't tell. The headline, America Prepares for the Midterms. The cover leader, America is vulnerable to electoral vandalism. Too many no longer believe elections are fair. That will be followed by four additional leader articles, beginning with leader number two, Take the iPhone, Garnish with Globalization. Tim Cook wrote a winning recipe for Apple. Will it work for his successor? Then, Move Fast and Militarize Things. How to Bolster the Arsenal of Democracy. America's new defense tech industry should be a model for Europe. Then, Israel. The High Price of Forever Wars. Benjamin Netanyahu is quick to start conflicts, but shows no ability to end them. And then finally, couples therapy. Pomp and pageantry won't save Britain's alliance with America. The special relationship? It's complicated. After that, we'll go to the United States section for Vote for Claude. Artificial intelligence is creeping into American lawmaking. Some legislators love using chatbots. Then to the international section for The Telegram, a dangerous blind spot in Donald Trump's Iran war strategy. America sets too little store by foreigners' beliefs and values. It's a costly mistake each time. And then, time permitting, to the culture section for Uncivil War. The rhetoric of war has changed, not for the better. Fitting literacy allusions are out. Jarring clips from Hollywood movies are in. So, that's the lineup. Back to the top we go for the cover leader. America is vulnerable to electoral vandalism. Too many no longer believe elections are fair. Largely because Donald Trump is so unpopular, his party will be trounced in the midterm elections in November. That is what The Economist's new forecasting model currently says. Democrats are almost certain to win the House of Representatives. They could even flip the Senate, a surprise for election nerds, because the map in this cycle strongly favors Republicans. Yet, although the outlook for Democrats is good, for America's democracy, it is alarming. Each party has come to see the other lot as cheats. Repeated meddling in election machinery by the president and his party, and their false claim that victory was stolen from them in 2020, have undermined voters' belief that elections are fair. The degrading contest to gerrymander congressional seats, the most intense in memory, further tells Americans that their politicians want to rig outcomes rather than compete. Some Democrats worry that Mr. Trump will steal the midterms. That is unlikely. But you don't have to expect the worst to fear the trend. Elections are not just about voters picking a winner. They are also a device for persuading the losers to accept the legitimacy of their opponent's claim on office. Sooner or later, the loser's loss of faith will cause a crisis. Midterm worriers can point to motive and opportunity. Losing the Senate as well as the House would sting Mr. Trump. The closeness of the Senate contest gives him a chance to meddle again. The midterms could also be a dry run for an attempt to steal the presidential election in 2028. Mr. Trump's constant efforts to weaponize the courts against his domestic enemies suggests he believes more than ever that rules are for losers. The worriers can also point to the president's behavior. He has issued executive orders to take bits of election administration away from the states and put the federal government in charge, supposedly to make the system more trustworthy. That is a familiar Trump move. First, identify a real flaw, a lack of trust he helped engender. Then, propose a plan that makes the problem worse, grabbing more power for himself. His scheme is unconstitutional and will probably fail. But it reveals his intent. If he could seize the running of elections, he surely would. If Mr. Trump cannot change the rules, he could still try to interfere on Election Day. In some places, conspiracy theorists will be in charge of ballot boxes. Some may believe the election in 2020 was stolen. Some MAGA loyalists have suggested he should dispatch ICE agents to polling stations to stop foreigners from voting illegally, which almost never happens. That would be illegal, and the courts would swiftly say so. The administration has been ambiguous. But should the temptation arise, it would not be hard to work out where to direct them. Democratic areas of Alaska, Maine, or Ohio, where control of the Senate will be decided, and where scaring minorities into staying home could help Republicans. Even if this did not change the result, it would sow distrust, which could provide a platform for post-electoral mischief. After the votes are counted, the president's party could once again file lawsuits, as it did the last time he lost. In 2020, judges threw them all out, a reminder that Americans can still have confidence in their courts. But MAGA world is litigious and has plenty of money. Never conceding defeat has become its organizing principle. The cases could drag on well past November 3rd. A loss in the courts is likely eventually, but the idea that someone, somewhere, has stolen the election may grow. Given such a litany of risks, you can understand the predictions of imminent doom. So it is worth underlining that although America's electoral system is untidy and frequently confusing, with rules that vary from place to place, it still works. The Constitution says that elections will be administered by the states, not the federal government. That limits any president's ability to mess with them. Even within states, election administration is decentralized, relying on county officials who take their jobs seriously, and on the sort of doughty volunteers usually found at bake sales. Across the country, officials committed to the integrity of the vote are preparing to repel attempts to undermine it. Instead, the damage is more likely to be further vandalism rather than outright theft. The world's democratic superpower, whose idealistic system of government was long admired elsewhere, is now also a cautionary tale about how fragile trust is. Only 25% of voters say they are confident the midterms will not suffer interference. A majority in both parties think the other side is too extreme. Only 10% say both parties are honest and ethical. In a recent poll, more than half of Americans reckoned their fellow citizens were morally bad. Only 17% of Britons and 7% of Canadians did so. That is a gloomy way for America to celebrate its 250th birthday this summer. This mistrust is not all the president's doing. Polarization predates him. Changes in media and technology matter. But a lot of it is. Trust in elections dipped after the Supreme Court decided Bush versus Gore after the vote in 2000. Then it recovered, until Mr. Trump came along. He has relentlessly sought advantage by casting doubt on the good faith and honesty of anyone who opposes him, from whichever party. Politicians like to claim that the election they are competing in is the most important of their lifetime. But Mr. Trump raises the stakes by framing each contest in existential, if not apocalyptic, terms. That may turn out to be this president's most enduring domestic legacy. Although he probably cannot steal the midterms, he may well further damage democracy. Dangerous ideas are taking root. If the other side are thieves and traitors, as he often suggests, partisans may once again feel that rising up after an election is their patriotic duty. If the result is close, they may reason that treachery is what got the other side over the line. If the other lot stole the election, to impose their policies on all Americans would be wrong. By taking away Americans' trust in each other, Mr. Trump is making it easier for future would-be strongmen to exploit their loathing. That was the cover leader. America is vulnerable to electoral vandalism. Too many no longer believe elections are fair. And we'll move on now to leader article number 2. Take the iPhone, garnish with globalization. Tim Cook wrote a winning recipe for Apple. Will it work for his successor? Sometimes a company encapsulates its times. Ford and its Model T captured the go-getting mood of the Roaring Twenties. IBM embodied the techno-optimism of the first computer era in the 1970s. General Electric epitomized the cutthroat capitalism of the 1990s. For much of this century, the company of the moment has been Apple. The iPhone, a sleek gateway to the all-consuming app economy, has been as evocative of the zeitgeist as Big Hair was of the 1980s. So has Apple's embrace of globalization, and especially of China. As a place first to make gadgets, then to sell them. For the past 15 years, this icon of the digital era and free trade has been led by Tim Cook. It may have been Steve Jobs, his legendary predecessor, who dreamt up the iPhone, but it was Mr. Cook who put one in 1.5 billion pockets, making the Apple logo ubiquitous from San Francisco to Seoul. Apple's market value has grown 11-fold on Mr. Cook's watch as, counting everything, including dividends, he has stuffed some $4.6 trillion into the pockets of Apple's shareholders. That is over $850 million for every day of his long tenure. On April 20th, Apple said that this tenure will end in September. Mr. Cook's successor, John Ternus, must decide if this winning formula, smartphones plus global supply chains equals $1 trillion in cumulative net profit over 15 years, needs updating for the age of artificial intelligence, or AI, and geopolitical fracture. It is a tough call, and it matters beyond Apple. When Mr. Cook took over, his strategy was a bet on the future of technology and of the global economy. Technologically, Apple gambled that, as Jobs envisioned, the smartphone would be the principal interface between people and the digital world. That proved correct. As a result, Mr. Cook did not himself oversee the launch of any product as transformative as the iPhone. AirPods are popular, and Apple sells more watches than Switzerland, but these are mere smartphone accessories. The ambitious idea of an iCar was quietly scrapped. Who remembers anything about the Vision Pro apart from its $3,500 price tag. But by continuously improving the iPhone, expanding the range of phones, and selling them in more places, Mr. Cook built an empire. Apple's twin economic wager on global supply chains and China reflected the extent of globalization. By the 2010s, most goods trade barriers had gone. Each year, countries were exchanging products and services worth nearly 60% of world GDP, up from around 40% in the 1990s. China went from 10% of the global economy in 2011 to 17%, from technological supplicant to a frequent leader, and from 4 Apple stores to 50. Mr. Ternus, an Apple insider for many years, seems inclined to stick to the same approach. The danger is that AI and trade wars make Apple a bet on the past. It will thrive if making AI models is less lucrative than selling AI applications and the hardware on which they run. If trade barriers reconfigure cross-border supply chains rather than destroy them, and if relations between China and the West are strained but not ruptured. For now, conservatism is paying off. iPhones can still be designed by Apple in California, assembled in China, or increasingly in India. Apple must get its AI act together, but eschewing model making has mostly kept it out of a $3 trillion data center binge, which may end up in huge losses. Its market value is not far off from an all-time high of $4.2 trillion. It is easier than ever to see how all that could change. But many elements of the globalized, consumer-centric world Mr. Cook's Apple helped create are worth preserving. With luck, they will endure. That was our second Leader article. Take the iPhone, garnish with globalization. Tim Cook wrote a winning recipe for Apple. Will it work for his successor? And we'll proceed now to Leader article number 3. Move fast and militarize things. How to bolster the arsenal of democracy. America's new defense tech industry should be a model for Europe. The world is rearming fast. Military spending has increased in real terms every year for the past decade. The leap in 2024 was the largest in inflation-adjusted terms since the Cold War. European members of NATO, their bare armories exposed by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, will spend an additional 300 billion euros, or $353 billion, per year by the end of the decade. China's military spending grows each year by an amount equivalent to Taiwan's entire annual defense budget, even as the rest of Asia scrambles to keep up. But it is arms, not budgets, that deter. And producing those arms requires the right sort of defense industry, tailored to the wars of the future. The wars in Ukraine and Iran appear to hold different lessons. Ukraine has pioneered the use of low-cost drones, whose software is updated weekly, to stave off a much larger Russian army. Israel and America have used expensive F-35 jets, B-2 bombers, and air-launched ballistic missiles and scores of refueling tankers to attack Iran. In fact, they have much in common. One message is that Western countries need more defense manufacturing capacity. In just 40 days of war, America used up half of its stocks of high-end air defense munitions. Another is that armed forces need to balance a few high-end systems and a much larger number of cheaper, more numerous, and easily replaceable weapons. A third is that, regardless of whether a weapon is big or small, expensive or cheap, crude or uncrewed, what increasingly matters is the software inside. The most effective weapons are those infused with the best algorithms, trained on the best data, and updated most frequently. All this explains why America's defense industry is in the throes of dramatic change. Palantir, a data firm which builds the core of America's and NATO's command and control software, is now worth more than RTX, formerly Raytheon, the most valuable of the defense primes. Palantir, SpaceX, and Anduril form a trio of, quote, neo-primes. They behave like software-first firms competing with arms makers who came late to the software revolution. To make weapons, the neo-primes have drawn from modern manufacturing methods, including those of the car industry. Though their ability to scale up is unproven, they are hungrier than the incumbents and spend heavily on in-house R&D. The neo-primes have shaken up the defense industry for the better, even as the Pentagon has descended into chaos. Pete Hegseth, America's Secretary of War, as he styles himself, has carried out purges that have been the largest politically motivated mass sackings of top brass in modern American history. He appears to revel in war and violence rather than treating them with sobriety. Mercifully, though, he also has the right ideas about procurement, which should help America adapt to the new era of warfare. In November last year, Mr. Hegseth said the Pentagon would buy things faster, speeding up its Byzantine processes. He gave frontline commands a greater say in what gets bought, and he promised to draw more on commercial rather than bespoke technology. The changes should create the conditions in which upstarts can compete with the legacy firms to forge a more diverse and dynamic industry. Alas, Europe is far behind. It has hardly any big new defense tech companies. Small and innovative firms are stifled by a fragmented market, limited access to venture capital, and low demand from governments. Nearly all of Germany's 100 billion euro special defense fund will go on traditional kit. Last year, Britain's Defense Review said 10% of equipment spending should go to, quote, novel technologies. Astonishingly, some insiders argued this should include the F-35, a jet which first left production lines 20 years ago. Skycutter, a British drone company, recently won a big Pentagon contract, but the firm may have to leave Britain for want of orders there. It need not be this way. If Europe rebalances its spending and reforms procurement, its firms might compete with America's at a time when the NATO alliance is strained. The remarkable Ukrainian defense tech ecosystem that has sprouted up since 2022 is a valuable asset. As America steps back from Ukraine, Europe should lean in. Britain already works with Ukraine to develop interceptor drones. Germany also has a drone agreement with it, and this month, Rheinmetall set up a joint venture with Destinus, a Dutch firm making long-range missiles at a fraction of the cost of other models. Ukraine has offered to share battlefield data to train artificial intelligence, vital for the next weapon systems. Much more of this is necessary if the arsenal of democracy is not to depend on a handful of American firms. That was our third leader article, Move Fast and Militarize Things: How to Bolster the Arsenal of Democracy. America's new defense tech industry should be a model for Europe. And we'll move on now to the fourth leader article, Israel: The High Price of Forever Wars. Benjamin Netanyahu is quick to start conflicts, but shows no ability to end them. Not all wars are fought alike. One reason for the 78-year survival of Israel, a small democratic country in a mostly hostile region, is that its leaders long grasped that fact. They saw how big gains come from preventing wars, but when necessary, fighting them quickly with clearly defined and realistic aims. Short conflicts, they believed, should be a prelude to something much more valuable, a flourishing civilian life. In times of peace, a country may best grow, building up its economic and technological prowess. For these reasons, over decades, Israel's military doctrine wisely, if not always successfully, set out that wars should be limited and based on deterrence, early warning, and decisive action. So it is dismaying to see how Israel's current leaders have abandoned that approach. As Israelis mark the anniversary of their independence this week, they are embroiled in too many conflicts of various levels of intensity that have been dragging on for 2.5 years. The Israel Defense Forces are overextended on 4 fronts. The army has seized, quote, security zones in the Gaza Strip, South Lebanon, and Syria, and is engaged in an increasingly pitiless occupation of the West Bank. Together with America, it has just carried out a campaign of airstrikes on Iran, the second round in less than a year. For all their short-term operational successes, it is not clear what benefit prolonging these conflicts will bring, and the costs are mounting. The way Israel fights its wars has become bloody and ineffective. Israel was fully justified in responding forcefully to the massacre of its people by Hamas on October 7, 2023, and the missile launches by Hezbollah the next day. But the tactics it has since used in the Gaza Strip and southern Lebanon have caused many thousands of unjustified deaths and continue to cause suffering for millions of civilians displaced from their homes. Despite those years of fighting, Israel has failed to eliminate the threats on its border. Both Hamas and Hezbollah, though weakened, retain a grip. Compounding those humanitarian and military failures are strategic ones. Traumatized by October 7th, Israel has sought the unattainable goal of winning total victories to guarantee total security. As a result, it has shunned more limited objectives that were achievable and which could have reestablished deterrence and begun to build a more lasting settlement. It rejected proposals by the Biden administration to replace Hamas with the Palestinian Authority in Gaza. It has plunged Lebanon into another war rather than help its government limit the power of Hezbollah. In Syria, it is squandering an opportunity to reach a security agreement with the new government. And it is unclear that Israel has any influence over the on-off negotiations between America and Iran. Israel's defenders argue rightly that the Middle East has no simple diplomatic solutions, and that the Jewish state has earned the right to be eternally vigilant. But Israel's overwhelming military superiority is not a solution in itself. One consequence is that people who once sympathized with Israel in democracies around the world, most notably in Europe and America, have grown increasingly hostile to it. This is in large part the doing of Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister. Like his predecessors, he used to be reluctant to fight. Today, perhaps anxious to avoid a reckoning for his failings before October 7th, he seems driven to repeatedly escalate conflicts in the hope of, quote, changing the map of the Middle East. Israel's generals, who could once restrain overambitious prime ministers, have become hesitant to speak out. Elections are to be held by the end of October. Could they bring a new strategy? Campaigning will give Israelis a chance to debate whether it is wise to fight on so many fronts. Yet many feel unsafe after the massacre of 2023 and are unwilling to listen to moderate messages from their leaders. Voters and political opponents are not scared of confronting Mr. Netanyahu. They question him, often aggressively, over constitutional affairs, corruption, and his coalition's subservience to ultra-religious interests. But few seem ready to ask if Israel needs to fight its many wars for so long or so cruelly. The main opposition figures offer no compelling alternative, preferring to limit their criticism to ways in which military operations are being carried out. Israel's politicians are letting their people down. Voters need to hear hard truths. Israel's founding generations grasped that wars must have limits. Israelis need to recognize that, even after the horrors of October 7th, those limits still exist. That was Leader Article number 4, Israel, the High Price of Forever Wars. Benjamin Netanyahu is quick to start conflicts, but shows no ability to end them. And we'll pause here to remind you that you are listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This program featuring articles from the April 24th to May 1st edition of the magazine. And we'll turn now to Leader number 5, our fifth and final leader article in this issue. Couples Therapy. Pomp and Pageantry Won't Save Britain's Alliance with America. The special relationship? It's complicated. For preference, he talks to plants. But next week, King Charles III must stiffen his upper lip and get chummy with Donald Trump. The royal visit to Washington is an attempt by Britain's government to win back the president's favor by indulging his love of pomp and bling. It comes as the special relationship looks worse than at any point since 1956, when America vetoed an Anglo-French attempt to seize the Suez Canal. Today, another war over a Middle Eastern waterway has led to another blazing row. "This is not Winston Churchill we are dealing with," grumbles Mr. Trump of Sir Keir Starmer, Britain's beleaguered prime minister. Sir Keir has responded with the strongest words in British English. "I'm fed up." Mr. Trump is mostly to blame. He bullies and insults America's allies, started a war that hurts them, and rages when they don't immediately back him. Fully 53% of them now believe that America is a negative force in the world, up 19 points since January. Given a choice, they are twice as likely to favor more cooperation with Europe than with America. Most long-term relationships have ups and downs. When Churchill first spoke of a, quote, special relationship, America, Britain, and other allies had just defeated Nazism and were confronted by the Soviet Iron Curtain, which Churchill christened in the same speech. Over the next 80 years, they linked arms against communism, shared copious intelligence, and shed blood together in Korea, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Often, Britain has overestimated its importance. As Alex von Tunzelman, a historian, said of Anthony Eden, the prime minister during Suez, he had believed it might be possible for British brains to run the world with American muscle. He had not expected the Americans to develop ideas of their own. Always, a hefty share of Britons have been wary of following Uncle Sam's lead. Many were calling Sir Tony Blair America's, quote, poodle, long before the Iraq War became a fiasco. But no British government has ever imagined that an American president might turn his back on the relationship. Until now. The relationship may recover when Mr. Trump has left office, but Britain should not take this for granted. Post-Brexit, it is adrift politically, geostrategically, and economically. Its government is weak. It has lost its role linking Europe to America, and it is relatively poorer. In 2007, its income per person was 20% lower than America's. Now it is over 30% lower. Aggravating all this is an identity crisis. Britain's global ambitions are as confused as its messages on whether or not it welcomes migrants. Future, factually grounded American presidents will surely conclude that relations with Brussels or Delhi matter far more than those with dear old Blighty. Yet Britain has real strengths, and indeed leverage. It is good at attracting global talent. It is located in an enviable spot and has military bases around the world. It has unique prowess in intelligence, special forces, maritime security, defense tech, and AI safety. Its soft power is huge for such a small country, which helps explain why MAGA types are so obsessed with London's supposed downfall while not giving a monkey's about Berlin or Paris. The first step towards rediscovering Britain's mojo is to be honest about its shortcomings. As Mr. Trump says, Britain needs to spend more on defense. In the past, it has assumed that any wars would be fought alongside the Americans, so gaps in equipment did not matter much. Now that it may have to act alone, or with Europeans, it looks naked. Britain should accept nuclear dependence on America for now, though hedge for the future, and preserve intelligence cooperation. It should move closer to Europe, and it needs skillful leadership. This week, Sir Keir was further weakened by his attempts to explain how he appointed Peter Mandelson, a friend of Jeffrey Epstein, a dead American sex offender, as envoy to the court of Mr. Trump. Alas, leadership is something Sir Keir is unlikely to provide. That was Leader Article number 5, the final Leader Article in this issue, Couples Therapy. Pomp and pageantry won't save Britain's alliance with America. The special relationship? It's complicated. And we move now to the United States section for Vote for Claude. Artificial intelligence is creeping into American lawmaking. State legislators love using chatbots. Kent Rowe is a busy man. In addition to his full-time job as a farmland appraiser, he sits on the board of a utility company and on the council of his local Lutheran church. If that wasn't enough already, for up to 40 days a year, he serves as one of 70 lawmakers in South Dakota's House of Representatives. It is grueling work, without much help. South Dakota has the smallest legislative staff in the country. Roughly 60 staffers help lawmakers with research and drafting legislation. These days, Mr. Rohr relies increasingly on artificial intelligence, or AI, to manage his workload. The representative says he uses AI chatbots for research, crafting arguments, and mulling over talking points. "Honestly, I love it," he enthuses. "It's a search engine on steroids." He sometimes uses AI to help write bits of legislation, too. The lawmaker runs first drafts of bills through Grok, an AI tool developed by Elon Musk's XAI, to refine his ideas or check which other states might have passed similar laws. He likes to prompt Grok to apply what he calls a, quote, constitutional stress test on proposed legislation. It's an accepted tool, same as a calculator is to do math, or a cell phone is to do phone calls, he points out. We're not in the world of buggy whips anymore. Usage of AI is booming among state lawmakers and their staff. A survey by the National Conference of State Legislatures, a nonpartisan grouping of sitting lawmakers, found that 44% of state legislative staff used AI in their work last year, up from just 20% in 2024. Governors and state agencies are also adopting the technology, in part to prune back excessive and badly written regulations. Doomers warn of a deluge of AI-generated, quote, slop laws, gumming up legislatures, to say nothing of representatives merely regurgitating whatever Claude or ChatGPT tells them. Most state legislators turn to AI out of need. "You have a lot of workload and no staff to help you out," laments Nick Hoheisel, a Republican member of the Kansas House of Representatives. He says research that previously took him hours can now be done in a matter of minutes. AI can also help stretched legislators who are expected to grasp a bewildering array of policy issues push back against better resourced lobbyists. Monique Priestley, a Democratic member of the Vermont House of Representatives, says she uses AI to fact-check lobbyists on the fly during committee hearings. "I've actually caught lobbyists in lies," she says. For lawmakers using general-purpose models, however, AI making stuff up is a big problem. Mr. Rohr says he occasionally runs an AI prompt, quote, 10 times or 100 times over to calibrate for the right answer. Mr. Hoheisel, for his part, says AI models hallucinate the most when it comes to case law. In any case, bills drafted with the help of AI are still overseen by lawyers, editors, and researchers, notes John McCullough, the head of South Dakota's Legislative Research Council. But lawyers on legislative councils deal with crushing workloads as it is. A wave of AI slop laws might easily overwhelm them. At a deeper level, there is growing unease that lawmakers too reliant on AI may find it harder to think critically on important issues. Thought processes like writing, problem solving, and reasoning are inherent to the job. Offloading that to an AI raises stark questions about what it means to be a legislator. I do worry that chatbots take away independent thought admits Mr. Hoheisel in Kansas. Your constituents aren't electing Claude or ChatGPT. They're electing you. That was an article from the United States section, Vote for Claude. Artificial intelligence is creeping into American lawmaking. State legislators love using chatbots. And we'll move now to the international section for The Telegram, a dangerous blind spot in Donald Trump's Iran war strategy. America sets too little store by foreigners' beliefs and values. It's a costly mistake each time. The American president's tone was harsh, and the cause was not hard to identify. A war meant to last a few days had just passed the 6-week mark. Addressing American troops, the president told them they were battling an, quote, evil foe whose, quote, mad schemes must be defeated. Though regime leaders are proving stubborn, quote, we are hitting them hard where it hurts, he said. The president added a blast of cultural chauvinism. America's armed forces can do things that, quote, no one else can, he told assembled soldiers. You are in action far from home to help remake a region that has never been united in peace. As you fight, you should, quote, thank God that you come from a society whose unity makes it strong. To reassure doubters back home, the Pentagon deployed stirring facts. In briefings, beribboned generals enumerated bombs dropped and targets destroyed. Bridges and oil refineries are legitimate targets too, growled the generals as the war dragged on. For roads and fuel help hostile forces to remain on the move. Yet, as days of war turned to weeks, blizzards of statistics could not obscure a stubborn reality. America had misjudged what it would take to break an adversary's will. So far, so familiar, especially to critics of President Donald Trump's bungled war in Iran. They see a distinctly Trumpian disaster unfolding in the Middle East, reflecting all the president's worst traits. Those include hubris, impatience, an over-reliance on threats to resolve complex problems, a tendency to respond with overwhelming force to signs of intransigence, and a damaging lack of curiosity about how foreigners really think. In fact, the war in those opening paragraphs took place in 1999. The president quoted is Bill Clinton. American military planners estimated it might take 3 days for America and its NATO allies to break the will of Serbia's leader, Slobodan Milosevic, using air power to pound his armed forces until he halted a murderous campaign of ethnic cleansing against Albanians in the former Yugoslav region of Kosovo. In the end, it took 79 days of escalating airstrikes before Serbia's nationalist regime capitulated, backed by credible threats of a land invasion by NATO forces. The Kosovo conflict is worth recalling today. An honest assessment of Mr. Trump's war-making must reckon with a dispiriting truth. Some flaws are distinctively his, such as his love of making cruel threats, impetuosity, and intolerance of being told unwelcome truths, so that with each passing month, he acts less like a modern commander-in-chief and more like an angry old king. But Trump-level mistakes have been made by earlier, very different presidents. It is not just Mr. Clinton. His fellow Democrats, John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson, thought that the Vietnamese would welcome America as an ally against communism. Instead, many saw Americans as just their latest colonial invaders. The notion that America keeps making the same mistakes is not mere snark from a British columnist. Within the American intelligence community, a whole school of analysis has sprung up in the past decade or two, focused on the country's cultural blind spots. The Kosovo War in 1999 is used as a case study. A much-cited paper on, quote, cultural topography, published in 2011 by two CIA veterans, Jeannie Johnson and Matthew Barrett, notes how American planners ignored underplayed differences in Serbia, a Balkan country whose National Day celebrates not a victory in war, but a glorious defeat at the hands of the Ottoman Turks in 1389. If analysts had put enough weight on Serbian views of honor, the paper concludes, they might have warned policymakers and generals to expect that, quote, Serbia would find victory by standing up to an overpowering military force when the world expected it to fold. Later, American impatience with cultural differences caused terrible harms in Afghanistan and Iraq. American commanders and leaders have a tendency to see foreign difficulties as problems to be solved or targets to be struck, quote, rather than terrain to be navigated, as Professor Johnson puts it. With Mr. Barrett, she co-founded the Center for Anticipatory Intelligence at Utah State University, training American spooks and other professionals to map cultural traits and use them to spot threats and openings. Mr. Barrett, a former CIA assistant director, would like policymakers to ask whether a desired foreign policy outcome would require another country to alter something fundamental about its culture or worldview. If that is the case, he would have Americans ask a sobering question. Over what period and with what resources is such cultural change achievable? Alas, the question is too rarely posed. One reason is that America is so strong militarily that strategy can be an afterthought. Indeed, when Britain was a great power, it could be just as clumsy. Americans are also too quick to recall turning Germany and Japan into democratic allies after 1945, and to assume the same can be done again, forgetting that it took total war and two atomic bombs. Mr. Trump scorns his predecessors for seeking to transform Middle Eastern countries into liberal democracies. He claims, falsely, to have already pulled off regime change in Iran by joining Israel in the killing of many top leaders there and encouraging, quote, reasonable leaders to step forward. But his administration is seeking cultural change in Iran, to be sure. His vice president, J.D. Vance, says that Mr. Trump wants Iran to behave, quote, like a normal country. That means a place which puts economic and commercial interests ahead of ideology, a big shift from Islamist nationalism. Put pessimistically, the Trump way of war involves making all America's old cultural mistakes, with the sole exception of excessive idealism. Not so long ago, foreign governments grumbled about American presidents with good intentions. Mr. Trump has solved that problem for them, but possibly only that one. That was an article from the international section, The Telegram, A Dangerous Blind Spot in Donald Trump's Iran war strategy. America sets too little store by foreigners' beliefs and values. It's a costly mistake each time. And at the outset of the program, I mentioned that, time permitting, we would include an article from the culture section, Uncivil War. The rhetoric of war has changed, not for the better. Fitting literary allusions are out. Jarring clips from Hollywood movies are in. But, unfortunately, time does not permit. So, in lieu of that article, which is interesting and occasionally humorous, here are some news briefs from The World This Week in Business. United Airlines reported bumper demand for business and premium travel, but it reduced its forecast of annual profit because of the extra costs it expects to incur from higher jet fuel prices as a result of the Iran war. Lufthansa cut 20,000 short-haul flights from its schedule in order to save 40,000 tons of fuel. Meanwhile, TUI, Europe's biggest travel company, lowered its profit outlook because of the, quote, volatile geopolitical backdrop. Tourists were delaying their holiday plans, it said, and demand was markedly lower for countries that abut the conflict zone, such as Egypt and Turkey. And finally, this. Litigation Day. America's Customs Agency began processing requests for refunds of Mr. Trump's tariffs from importers that had to pay them. In February, the Supreme Court ruled that duties imposed under the International Economic Powers Act were illegal. Some companies, including Costco and FedEx, have pushed to ensure that they get a payment. But it is not clear how many others will claim refunds. Some $166 billion was collected in the unlawful tariffs. And with that, we have reached the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the April 24th to May 1st edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veitch, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And as always, I remind you that if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other SunSounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand.